Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Secular Sunday for Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from Northeast Kansas. Coming up is George Kenney. Now, you will not get George Kenney regularly on Radio Free Kansas, but you will get him on the Fight and Talk Flyer Blogspot, the daily news aggregator that I publish at fightandcockflyer.blogspot.com. But what you're going to see here is the latest of Mr. Kenney, former State Department employee, graduate of colleges, you know, universities. You'll hear him with Gary Nosner, who wrote the book. He's a retired FBI agent who wrote the book Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Negotiator. Now, Mr. Kenney is busy, you know, like we all are, out here on the internet, and he's made a formal request, to go to Podcast Awards. It's linked at the program summary here at the Blog Talk radio station for Radio Free Kansas. And go through the category and nominate him. He's won it numerous times in the top 10 in the last few years, so I'm really advocating listeners. He gave me a special permit to broadcast these shows the last couple of weeks, largely because he's a contender. He is a contender. You know what I mean? Here we go without further ado. It's worth your time, bookmark. Go to this place. Here we go with Gary Nosner.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 11th. I may be wrong, but I still think Washington is not taking this hostage situation seriously enough. A short reprieve on the debt ceiling does not the crisis solve. You can't run a government by lurching from short-term crisis to short-term crisis, period. Some sort of long-term structural fix, that is, a procedural fix, is necessary. Welcome to Electric Politics. I'm George Kenney. A critical part of what's happening right now, however, involves the ability to communicate. Gary explains. We talk for 40 minutes. Let's listen. Today, I'm extremely honored and absolutely delighted to have as my guest Gary Nosner. Gary retired from the FBI in 2003 after a 30-year career His last position was as chief of the crisis negotiation unit. His memoir, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, was published in 2010 by Random House. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm delighted that you were agreeable to my request. This is really a thrill. I guess to start, I noticed in reading your book, and I apologize for not having read it thoroughly, but I noticed that you mentioned at one point that in your last position you had something like 11 or 12 supervisory agents under you, and then under them a couple of 300 to 350 agents. And I just wanted to sort of highlight for listeners who may not be familiar with the way that the U.S. government bureaucracy works, that's really a very senior position, isn't it?
Well, I think you would equate the unit chief position I was in, I guess people would most be familiar with, it would be like an army colonel, I suppose, in terms of the rank structure. But when we had a big operational matter, it would sort of be more akin to like a brigadier or something like that,
mm-hmm,
where
mm-hmm.
In an operational context, the authority exceeds to some extent the rank. But yeah, that's about where it would lay in the scheme of things.
And it's also interesting to me, trying to brush up very quickly on some of the literature, the professional literature on hostage negotiations and the psychology involved of hostage takers. But your experience at the FBI sort of tracked, in a sense, the development of this whole discipline, right? I mean, this is a pretty new thing, relatively speaking.
It is, relatively speaking. It really was started by NYPD back in the early 70s, and it was an effort to try to find a more effective way to deal with a variety of crisis siege events. And in those days, law enforcement had very few options. It was either surrender and come out, or we're going to come in and get you.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know historically, there were a lot of very unfavorable outcomes with hostages being killed, perpetrators obviously being killed, and police officers. And in even some terrible cases, police officers killing hostages by mistake. So
mm-hmm.
they felt they needed to do a better, come up with a better way. And that way essentially evolved into, instead of just charging in with guns blazing, we surround and contain the incident, and then we open up a dialogue to try to diffuse the situation. When someone's holding hostages, they feel pretty empowered. They feel as though they can dictate their demands, and those demands will readily be met. And then when it takes much longer to accomplish even very simple things, it slowly and steadily dissolves their sense of empowerment. You know, hence the title of my book, Stalling for Time.
Stalling for Time.
It's probably the number one tactic that we use to
mm-hmm.
slow things down and de-emotionalize.
Mm-hmm.
So that was highly effective for years. And then when I began to take over the program in the FBI, we moved that model even further down the road to more of a crisis intervention model, where we use the lessons learned through the counseling profession, because we found we were primarily dealing with, we law enforcement at large, highly emotionally charged situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So before you can logically present an alternative to someone, you first have to lower their emotional state and create a relationship of trust. And those are the skills that I think we really helped expand around the country, and the ones I'm the most proud of. And those are the ones that also I found have the broadest application in family life, dealing with our children, dealing with our employers, subordinates, superiors, customers, and of course, handling a whole range of real-life crises.
I completely lost my train of thought. I'm listening to you so attentively that I had four or five things I was thinking. This almost never happens to me. And I won't cut that out, by the way, for the audience.
That's fine.
I'm completely stunned. But the FBI is really the main base for negotiations in the U.S. government, right? I mean, you maybe other agencies have some negotiators, but you guys at the FBI are really the center for negotiation studies and practice.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, at the FBI Academy, it's not just providing training to new FBI agents. It's there's a whole range of specialty components there, and mine was one of those that, in addition to providing instruction, also conducted research to try to learn about more about this very complex business, and also responded operationally. So it gave us a real potent combination of skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
By responding operationally, we learned lessons in real life that helped us become better instructors.
Mm-hmm.
Through that process, we realized areas where we needed additional research. So it was a nice combination of tasks and responsibilities that I think allowed us to become in the forefront of that business. And also, to a greater extent some years ago, I think somewhat lesser now, but police departments almost exclusively relied on the FBI for knowledge and training in any number of specialty areas. That's diminished a bit today with the higher educational levels of police departments, the greater access they have to their own ability to gather information through the Internet and other ways. But certainly back at the height of my career, we were sort of the national and, in essence, international clearinghouse for knowledge and guidance in this very challenging issue of crisis or hostage negotiations.
So there's nothing like the original NYPD program, which the FBI borrowed for its own.
Well, all due credit, I mean, I always have tried to make a big point of saying that FBI New York did come up with this concept. Now,
mm-hmm.
they brought it to the FBI, and we recognized it as something, you know, they're really on to something there, and we needed to take their beginning efforts and you know, expand on it, learn more about it. Okay, it works, but why does it work, and how does it work, and how do we train people to do it, and how do we share this with the Brits and the Canadians and the Australians and others around the world? So that really took off. But again, I think it's certainly Frank Bowles and Harvey Schlossberg up in New York. I have to be given credit for the folks that came up with the original concept.
But are there local places like NYPD that are even going beyond the cutting edge, who are developing things that aren't yet done by the FBI in Washington?
Well, there, you know, not everybody does exactly what the FBI you know, recommends in these areas. There's certainly pockets around the country of police departments that have devoted a great deal of effort, time, and attention and training, and are just excellent in resolving a host of these situations. And there are other pockets around the country where people have never heard of it, surprisingly, because, you know, law enforcement in the United States is a very complex and varied thing. And in the United Kingdom, you have one police force. In Canada, you have several, but primarily the RCMP.
Mm-hmm.
But in the United States, we literally have thousands and thousands of police agencies.
Messy, so
the standardization of training and practice is, you know, is pretty varied.
Yeah, yeah.
And some are really good and some aren't.
Or less so, yeah.
I think the unique thing we brought to the FBI in terms of operational experience was, you know, the overseas kidnapping work, the overseas terrorism siege work.
Mm-hmm.
When there were big situations in the United States like Waco or,
mm-hmm.
or prison riots or
mm-hmm.
right-wing militia standoffs, those were all FBI experiences that yielded the lessons that later I think became pretty instrumental in guiding the profession at large.
Just on Waco for a second, because I think this is worth noting, you were originally in charge of the negotiations, and you managed to get quite a few people out unharmed, and then a more belligerent faction took over. And as I was thinking about this, I had to think to myself, well, you know, Gary must be bureaucratically very adept, because he went on to then take charge of all the training and run the first, you know, the first chief of the standalone unit. And so you survived, and your skills were recognized from that, but that was a disaster.
It was, and obviously it's very complicated and would take a great deal of time to peel back all the layers of that onion, but you essentially had it right. I was in charge of negotiations the first half or the first 26 out of the 52 days, and during that time we got 35 people out. There was a slow and steady growing frustration within the larger FBI bureaucracy, and I suppose the government, you know, to get this thing moving along, to try a more strident, you know, a more aggressive approach to resolving it, very, very much against what I advocated. And so I was rotated out at halfway point, and they did take on that more aggressive response, and not a single individual came out after I left. So I draw no solace from that, but I think when we examined Waco in the aftermath, I think all the reports and the studies and the independent examinations sort of clearly validated that what we had been doing the first half was indeed, you know, the right way to go, and in many respects, a cutting edge. We did so many innovative and creative things there that, despite a pretty challenging situation, perhaps the most anyone's ever faced, we were able to achieve some success and had a really good team and very competent people on it.
In this context, it's probably also worth noting a statistic that I've seen in a number of places, that hostage negotiators, when they're, you know, given the authority to run the show, 90% of the time situations are resolved successfully.
Well, yeah, but we would phrase it a little bit different, George. I mean, as negotiators, we do not want to paint ourselves as the ultimate decision maker. There's always sort of three individuals at an incident. There's the tactical team commander, who's in charge of containment and tactical force to resolve it if required.
Mm-hmm.
There's the negotiation team and its team leader, and then there's the on-scene commander. And that triumvirate has to work together in a very coordinated fashion. And in Waco, that certainly got out of kilter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think when law enforcement, going to your larger question, has demonstrated patience and creativity, the solution rate is in the 90 percentile in hostage situations.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
Now, there are some situations where, regardless of how well we conduct our negotiations, we're facing someone who is, you know, prepared to die and perhaps wants to die more than they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And those are tough ones, and you can't win them all.
Yeah. All right. Well, now, and as a sort of a sequel to all that, let me just say again that I didn't say, so I'll say for the first time, your memoir is a great read. I haven't read it all because, unfortunately, I just got started reading it yesterday. But it's a terrific read. I stayed up too late last night reading it. And for people who are interested in the FBI and sort of, you know, some of the audience may think the FBI is never any good, which is not true. But if you want to see really the best side of the FBI, this book is a tremendous book. Okay, now.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I say that all quite sincerely. Now, Gary, let's switch gears. The reason that I contacted you was a really crazy idea that I had about how your skill set might apply to the current standoff between the president and Congress. And your first reply to me was, well, the Republicans aren't holding a gun to anybody's head, and so there are some differences, but, you know, maybe some similarities. And as I've been thinking about this, well, it's true that there isn't literally a gun being held to anybody's head, but there are real consequences to having programs shut down or worse, having the U.S. default on its debt. And even if there's not a direct death involved, there are, as was in the news just the other day, little kids having last chance cancer treatments at NIH who are not getting them, and other kinds of things that could quite easily, imaginably, turn into deaths or serious harm to people. And as I was having a nap this morning in preparation for talking with you, I had this dream where there was this giant gun, this, you know, huge gun, and I don't know, maybe there's a metaphor. It's not that the Republicans are holding just a normal kind of gun to people's heads, but we're talking about melting down the U.S. government or maybe melting down the world economy, and that is a threatening act, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it depends on which side you come out of the equation. You know, as our country's evenly divided, there's probably half the people think it's all the Republicans' fault, and those folks tend to watch the news that reinforces their point of view, and then folks on the other side tend to watch the news and programming and read the editorials and radio programs that support their point of view and say, oh, no, it's really because the Democrats did this. So you can go back and forth with all this. I mean, it's not a pure hostage situation in that someone's life is being threatened in that direct way, but you're quite right, and I don't argue the point that there's some similarities here. What I really see is two sides that have lost their ability to communicate calmly and effectively. And what we have right now, in essence, is negotiations on the airways. They're not really talking to each other. They're yelling at each other through the news media. And, you know, I've been watching the news, and one side gets on and says, well, we could do this today if they would do that. And the other side says, well, if they'll do this, we can do this. Well, they ought to be sitting down in a room working this out rather than slinging these accusations and supporting their points in the public arena. In fact, negotiations is always far more effective when it's done out of the spotlight of public attention,
mm-hmm.
because then you remove from the equation the most volatile part, and that's when people have to position themselves in keeping with what they feel their audience expects from them, and then it causes them to be intransient, and they won't get off of that position. So it's almost like when we had the Camp David Accords, and Jimmy Carter takes Begin and Sadat up to Camp David, totally away from the press, totally away from anybody, and he basically keeps them prisoner there till they sit down and talk again, and they come up with, the Camp David Accords, which is probably still one of the most significant accomplishments in Middle East diplomacy in history. And part of that is because he just made them stick with it, look for common ground, and try to put off at least initially those areas that are acrimonious and are going to be difficult, if not impossible. So you always first seek the areas where we can find agreement. And once you create that position of trust and demonstrate an ability to work together, then you can tackle the tougher issues. But in many respects, they're going about it pretty badly.
Well, I would have a different view that it's sort of just one side and the other side, and he said, she said. I think the history of American politics does not support the idea that anybody in Congress can use.
I don't argue that point, George. I mean, I think it does. I would agree with you from the point that this is not the time and place in the governmental process where these kinds of tough, thorny issues have been resolved. They've been done in other ways, and I think it's unfortunate to drag that into this budgetary process.
So I'm just trying to think how to apply expertise that you've developed and that hostage negotiators have built up over the years. I mean, there aren't that many exactly comparable situations. You talk about one where someone had tried to take the USS Yorktown hostage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first thing you have to do is defuse. If you can imagine, and I use this as a graph all the time, if you can imagine a child's teeter-totter,
right,
and it's in the incline, and at its upper stage on the side that's elevated, it's emotions.
Right.
And on the side that's touching the ground, it's called rational behavior. And the point being, it's an absolute, unarguable given that when emotions are high, rational behavior and thought is low. And I would argue that that's where this process is now between the parties. So before you can get someone to consider a logical argument, you've got to change the balance on that teeter-totter. You've got to lower first the emotions. And as you see, as the emotional side comes down, the rational thought and behavior side rises. It's a pretty basic way to illustrate it,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
That's what I see going on here. As long as we have different politicians from their parties stepping up to the cameras in the Capitol and spinning it their way, and I make no value judgment as to who's right or wrong here. I'm just saying, but as long as we are trying to tackle this issue in the public limelight, it makes it more difficult to do so.
I think I take your point about the emotional stuff, and
mm-hmm.
I think actually starting at the beginning with what the Republicans have attempted to do using the debt ceiling law, perhaps I'm wrong, but it seems to me it shows that there's a great deal of emotional turmoil among them, and a frustration that they can't get what they want through any other means. That would be similar in many ways to a hostage taker, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that's right. When a lot of times people will engage in hostage taking, because they feel as though no one's listening to them, no
mm-hmm.
one's
mm-hmm.
Hearing me. Their primary intent is not to harm the hostage. Their primary intent is to get their way. And if they feel as though the only way they can get their way is to get everyone's attention, to listen to them, and to comply with their desires, then they can act outrageously. And clearly there's parallels in this instance.
And then the second step, from a hostage negotiator point of view, it's inadvisable to just start giving stuff to the hostage takers, right? I mean, you want to have a quid pro quo. You want to have the dialogue, active listening, as you've described it.
Yeah. In fact, in a hostage situation, in a pure hostage situation, we have a saying that you never give something without getting something in return, because if you do that repeatedly, you've only conveyed to the other side that if you continue to demand and you continue to hold out and I continue to make concessions, then there's really no incentive for you to be reasonable or to behave reasonably.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a quid pro quo. There has to be a sense that we neither are going to get all that we want. We have to find some workable middle ground, even if it leaves us both with something far less than what we would ideally like. And that's the part that, you know, politicians, whatever they are or not, I think certainly in years past we've had people who were, to some extent, statesmen who understood this. You know, the book that just came out about Tip O'Neill and
mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan and their political differences, yet their Chris Matthews' book, their ability to sort of work together on important issues on the country's behalf, that's the kind of statesmanship that I think is something that we seem to lack today, and that's unfortunate.
Matthews had worked for Tip O'Neill, of course, and a former Peace Corps volunteer, Matthews, and then also a former Capitol Hill cop, actually.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, then there's another part of it, and I'm really curious about how you would see this. You described in various stories about your experience with hostage situations how, and it depends on the skill of the negotiator and the situational variables, but at the same time that you're establishing a rapport and building trust, you're also allowing at the edges just a little bit of steel to show, so that and in this case the president has an option, I believe, and a number of people far more educated than I do believe, of telling the Congress, well, if you don't want to pass a debt ceiling, that's okay. We can keep running the government anyway. And the White House has so far firmly maintained the line, well, it's up to the Congress to do this, expecting that the Congress will. But I'm sort of wondering at what point might it be useful in the back and forth for the White House to be able to sort of, you know, look out of the corner of their eye at such possibilities.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit more difficult to say. But, you know, the concept you're talking about, good cop, bad cop, or it goes further back. I remember as a young student learning about Teddy Roosevelt's walk softly but carry a big stick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you present a desire and a willingness and an openness and a desire to communicate effectively and peacefully and accomplish something, but out there, without being too explicit about it, is the potential for, you know, far more dire consequences. And mm-hmm. of course, we do this in a hostage situation. You know, Mr. Bank Robber, you're in there with your hostages, talk to the nice negotiator and try to act reasonably, and we're going to get you out of this alive, or, you know, potentially you'll have to deal with these big thugs out here who, I don't mean to use thugs as a pejorative, I mean the big strong guys on the SWAT team who may not be as thoughtful in their handling of you. I mean, that's basically, a calculus a guy has to run, you know, which is in my best interest. And you're more likely to come to the negotiation table. That's why you see in labor negotiations, there's always when they have an agreement, it's always in the 11th hour, because the nuclear option of a strike and everybody losing, you know, looms larger and larger, and it finally pushes somebody to the point of making a concession. And I suspect that's what's going to happen here. What will trigger all this right now, both sides, the Republicans and Democrats, are trying to win over public opinion. That's all that's going on right now. And when that public opinion manifests itself strongly enough, and there's enough outrage over the consequences of the government being shut down, then you're going to see the pressure mount, and whoever has the most pressure will probably be the one that I don't like to use the word cave in, but will reconsider their position.
But the problem with that is that the Republicans, the diehard hostage takers, are coming from districts.
No, George, I don't expect them to ever change. But, you know, as I study the situation, I don't pretend to be a political scientist, but at some juncture, you know, John Boehner's really in the hot seat. You know,
mm-hmm.
does he cater to his right-wing element in his party, or does he at some point time say, now the risk has gotten too far to me, and I have to take a stand and bring the rest of the party to work with the Democrats to get this thing passed through. I think he will come to that point. The interesting thing is, will the Democrats or the White House give him a carrot to give him a rationale, a sense that he accomplished something out of this? Nobody likes to be seen as having totally capitulated and accomplished nothing. So, you know, what I would be looking for is what little bone can I throw them that gives them a sense that, okay, you know, we did get something out of this. This fight was worthwhile, whether it really was or not. They need a face-saving sort of, you know, indicator.
Well, I agree with that, Gary, but it is very tricky because we haven't had a budget for 4 years, and this minority in the minority party, I mean, the 2012 elections, the Democrats won more votes for the president, they won more votes for the Senate, and they won more votes for the House of Representatives, but because of the way districts are designed and also gerrymandered, the Republicans wound up with a lot more seats. So the Democrats really are the majority party, but if this kind of situation continues and we have another one of these crises and another one and two or three a year, you can't run a country. You can't pull an economy out of a recession. It's really impossible to govern. And so on the one hand,
I don't disagree with you at all, George. Mm-hmm, I really don't. Mm-hmm. And there is no easy solution to this. I mean, but, you know, it seems to me that the primary motivating factor for today's politicians is re-election.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be settled when the majority of both parties decides that it's in their personal re-elective interests to go one way or another, and not a moment before. Yeah, and you're right. This is why the Tea Party is pretty inflexible, because none of them are threatened politically.
Well, because of the districting problem, I think the Democrats have to get something like a 6% national advantage before they can retake the House, which is almost impossible, at least, you know, for a long time. So
it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's also I've only seen, I think, one or two places, but there's some people that suggest the president can unilaterally, on his constitutional authority, raise the debt limit. Now, that would be like throwing a nuclear bomb into the process, but I wonder what would happen.
Well, I think he can, and I think also there are several different kinds of arguments. And in fact, one of the main proponents I interviewed recently who argues that no matter what the president does, if the Congress puts him in this position by acting or not acting, he's going to break some kind of a law. He can't decide on his own what programs not to fund. There's a whole long legal history of the president's trying to get power over funding. Nixon tried it, to try to impound funds from various programs, and Congress was pursuing him in the courts until that was overtaken by Watergate. There are questions about line item veto, which courts ruled unconstitutional. But basically, the Congress can't say to the president, okay, you do our job now. The system isn't going to work that way.
No, I know. Well, I think the biggest victim out of all this for me, I mean, you could certainly say the American people, but it's civility. These are intelligent guys. I mean, they're all smart fellows and ladies. And you know, it's really difficult for me, as someone made my life out of negotiating, to understand how reasonable people can't come together and come up with reasonable solutions. I've been doing it my whole life, and if it works in a desperate hostage situation, I guarantee it can work in something like this. But it takes courage. I wrote an editorial piece for the New York Times that they did not publish, but I called it The Courage to Compromise. You have to, at some point in time. You remember Joe McCarthy when, I forget, that attorney said, sir, have you no decency? I keep waiting for somebody to say that to those who are blocking this. You know, do you have no sense of national pride? Are you sense of patriotism? I'm surprised we've gotten so civil. We don't hear those kinds of things, but it's what I would be thinking. You know, how can you, because of your partisan interests, put the country in this pickle? Come on, let's work together. Let's come up with a solution that works.
Well, you know, you've made a great point, Gary, because what's missing here is a sense on the part of the White House, or even maybe of various members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, that what you need are professional negotiators to come in and and try to pour oil on the waters, because politics as usual is just not enough to fix it. You need to have real professionals.
You need a mediator.
Yeah.
What you almost need is somebody, you know, with the kind of skills that I have, mm-hmm. or had, or whatever you want to say, that has Republicans in one room, and in another room we got the Democrats. And I go over to the Republicans and I'm like, hey, listen, what is really important to you? What are your needs here? You know, and then I go over to the Democrats, and I come back and say, well, if they did this, would you do that? You know, and you have to navigate it for them, because if you just put them in the room together, then all the built-up animosity, the sense of victimization, whatever it might be, the political jousting for power that cannot be overstated, that all comes into play. So you almost need somebody who is neutral and not vested one way or another that says, come on, I'm going to help you guys find a solution. But, you know, that doesn't appear to be in the offing, because they all think they're brilliant negotiators, and, of course, very few of them are.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So it's a real pickle. To my mind, it's not that dissimilar to the run-up to the Civil War, and I don't think we're going to have another violent Civil War, but I think that there are sectional differences that may prove insurmountable. I don't know.
Well, to me, I'll tell you, while I'm in Florida now, I'm here to attend a high school reunion.
Ah.
And in the build-up to this thing, you know, I'm following things on Facebook and reconnecting with old classmates and so forth, and there's people who feel pretty compelled to share in this forum that's meant just to socially reactivate people, voicing some very strong opinions about the political process, you know, which I don't think is really appropriate. But what it shows you is the depth of the division in this country. I've never seen anything like it before, where you have to be very careful with even old friends and relatives and so forth. They've always said to be careful about talking about religious and politics, mm-hmm. but I think you have to be very careful these days, because there's people that have very, very strong opinions, and then sadly we get those reinforced by whichever media outlets that kind of tell the story, the narrative as we believe it to be, and we don't have those opportunities. You know, they always talk about Congress leaving town every weekend, and they do, where in the past they used to at least socialize together, and you know, people want to work with people they like and people they know. It's
exactly.
Very hard to throw a tantrum with somebody that you've socialized with and that you know is a good person, even though you may be ideologically at different places, and that's just what's missing.
Take them in small groups off to Hawaii for a week or two.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd lock them in a room and say, hey, you
yeah.
don't get to come out until you solve the problem. No food, no money, no nothing. This is it, guys. You know, and make it happen. And I do believe that most Americans, there's always going to be a fringe on either side that for which compromise is something they're just not interested in. But I think for the overwhelming majority of Americans, like any people really, they want to get things done. They understand that they can't have it all, that they have to. You know, they like the things to be more the way they like them than not, but they know that they can't have everything, so they have to make some compromises. And those are sort of, flexible belief systems that seem to be kind of hiding today in the public sector anyway.
It's so true. And you have a quote ahead of one of your chapters from Kipling, when you can keep
yeah.
your head about you when others are losing theirs.
Well, that's the point I was trying to make earlier about, first and foremost, keeping this away from the appearance in front of the cameras. You know, I mean, before, there's an old saying, the first thing I taught negotiators through the years, the very first words out of my mouth in the FBI's National Crisis Negotiation course was self-control. Before I can begin to influence someone else's behavior, I first and foremost have to have my own in control. And it's just a given, and I would submit anybody could try to argue against that, and they're going to be wrong. So we can't really accomplish anything if we ourselves are not behaving in a calm and rational way. So that's the first part of it. And I've heard some of those voices in the current debate, but they seem to be sort of marginalized. The news media tend to gravitate to those who say the most inflammatory quote of the day. And, what was the big thing in the news today? Some senior White House person unnamed says, we're winning. And then John Boehner reacts to that this morning. They think this is a game. You know, it's all hyperbole over something very trivial. You know, we got to keep our emotions and you know, deal with this thing in a calm manner. To me, it's I've just seen it too many times, and why these guys can't seem to figure it out is, I think, something that saddens probably the whole country.
Well, for me at least, I think that this is enormously helpful and really adds a necessary perspective to the impasse.
We have to know that people that don't agree with us, they're not necessarily right, but they're not necessarily wrong. You know, I'm not all right, they're not all wrong. And we have to look at life through their eyes and look at it from their position. And we have to be willing, first and foremost, to listen to them and to try to understand and then try to find some common ground. That's what negotiations is all about. It's how society works. It's how people live together in a communal fashion, which we've done since the dawn of time. We find ways to cooperate and work together more than not. And it's sad that people functioning at, you know, supposedly such a high level of responsibility and with such high levels of education are behaving so childlike.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I shudder to think what people around the world think of us at this point. But
I think some of our shine, some of our luster gets blemished or diminished, however you want to say it, every time these kinds of stories come out. I mean, there's plenty of people that don't like the United States around the world, but most people, you know, when you get one-on-one, and I have many friends around the world, they think very highly of us, but they get a little disappointed when they see this kind of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Rightfully so.
Gary, we ran almost 10 minutes longer than I said we would, but...
This has been
excellent. And again, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. I mean, it's very gracious of you, and I really do appreciate it. And I don't know how to help propagate your approach to this, but it's certainly a very worthy one and should be added into the mix.
I hope these guys will come to this conclusion, or common sense will prevail at some point in time. But you know, I know as a voter, I'll give an analogy. When I watch the news, I don't, when somebody says, well, you had it first here, I said, I don't want it first, I want it accurate. and when I hear somebody be very uncompromising and very demonstrative and very aggressive, I say, you know, that's not the kind of guy I support. Or, I'm looking for that thoughtful, quieter, intelligent person who really wants to roll up their sleeves and solve a problem. And we all deserve that.
You're of the older generation of civil servants who grew up with that and who idealized that, and I have so much admiration. My dad was older than you, but he was had that attitude too, coming out of the Second World War, where he was in the war and he thought after the war, you know, this was crazy. How can I do something to help prevent these wars? And so he took the GI Bill and went to college and mm-hmm. went into the Foreign Service and felt that would be a useful thing to do.
Well, I was lucky. As you read in the book, I wanted to be an FBI agent since I was a young kid. And,
12,
my dream came true. I couldn't have been more fortunate. And, and I always looked at it as, public service. I get a little angry sometimes when I hear some of the anti-government rhetoric, because the people I knew and worked with in the government, you always have a bad egg here and there, but by and large, were people who worked really hard and wanted to do the right thing and tried to do the right thing. And I think we need to remember that.
That's right. And I don't care what all the libertarians may say, we have to have government. Gary, listen, thank you again.
My great pleasure, George. And I hope there was some helpful injects of some ideas and thoughts here.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Brilliant. Thanks again, Gary. Sounds simple, doesn't it? But this is a very complex skill set. listening all too often being underrated. Okay, on to next week. Our announced schedule may change as I'm penciled in to talk with an eminent government expert about the current crisis. He may not entirely agree with me, by the way, but that's okay. When things are a bit more settled, I'll try to post a schedule running into November. One last reminder. If you haven't done so yet, please nominate the Electric Politics Podcast at the annual Podcast Awards. That's podcastawards.com. Nominate the Electric Politics Podcast just once in the political news category. You have until midnight on the 15th. Nominations make up a very large part of the scoring to get selected into the top 10 finalists, so our success depends on you. Please take a moment and help. Again, that's podcastawards.com. Thanks. That's it then for this week. As always, it's a great honor and a real pleasure for me to be able to bring you these shows. Thanks very much for listening, and please stay tuned to Electric Politics.
Sunday, October 8, 2013, Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky joined with Afghan activist Malala Joya to speak on the issue of humanitarian intervention. This event was held at the Unitarian Church in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Radio Project. Here now is Noam Chomsky.
The past of humanitarian intervention, the history is not very glorious. The future, that actually depends on us. The concept itself has become fashionable quite recently, but the concept is very old. In fact, just about every act of violence and aggression in history falls under the category of humanitarian intervention, at least if we believe the voices of the perpetrators. So that shows up. There is scholarship, academic scholarship on the topic, and it shows up very clearly there. So, for example, one of the main scholarly books dealing with the humanitarian intervention in modern period by Sean Murphy finds three examples of humanitarian intervention in the period before the Second World War. The first was Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. The second was Hitler's takeover of the Sudetenland. And the third was Japan's conquest of Manchuria and North China. Now, of course, he didn't mean that these were real humanitarian interventions, but he meant that they were the standard kind. They were claimed to be humanitarian interventions. So Mussolini invaded Ethiopia to uplift and Christianize and civilize the backward people of the country, actually the same phrases that President McKinley used when he invaded the Philippines earlier in the century, uplift and Christianize them. He uplifted a couple hundred thousand of them all the way to heaven. And the Philippines have yet to recover from the humanitarian gesture. Mussolini's invasion was horrendous and atrocious. Hitler invaded, took over the Sudetenland in order to, for the noblest of purposes, to end ethnic cleansing, to allow the conglomerate of people there to live in peace under the framework of the superior technology and culture of German civilization. When the Japanese invaded Manchuria and North China, their goal was to create an earthly paradise and to protect the poor people of the region from the Chinese bandits who were trying to undermine this noble project, at least those of them who survived the slaughter, a huge, monstrous slaughter. And that's pretty typical. Now, the early history of humanitarian intervention is quite similar. Actually, one of the earliest modern cases, and one of particular interest to us, should be, is, happens to be right here. In 1629, the King of England gave a charter for the Bay Area colony of the Bay Area, and the goal of the goal of the settlement was to save the natives here from their fate, bitter pagan fate. The goal was, the principal end of this plantation, King said, was to civilize and Christianize them. And if you look up on the internet, you can find the great seal of the Bay Colony of Massachusetts, that's us. It depicts an Indian with holding two spears pointed down in a sign of peace, and there's a scroll coming out of his mouth which says, "Come over and help us." So the colonists who came were just responding to this plea from the benighted natives to please come over and help them. Well, a strange thing happened. It was actually discussed later years. Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, in the two centuries later, in the 1820s, expressed his surprise at what happened. He said that the wisdom of Providence, which is inscrutable to mere mortals, caused the natives to disappear like the withered leaves of autumn, even though the colonists had constantly respected them. It's just one of those mysteries. We can't understand the Lord's wisdom and depth. Actually, the perpetrators knew much better. So Revolutionary War hero General Henry Knox, he was the first Secretary of War in the newly liberated colonies, he described what they were doing. What they're doing, he said, is the utter extirpation of all the Indians in the most populous parts of the Union by means more destructive to the Indian natives than the conduct of the conquerors of Mexico and Peru. And he warned that a future historian may mark the causes of this destruction of the human race in sable colors. Hasn't happened. Shortly after Joseph Story's musings on Providence, another one of the perpetrators, the architects of the extirpation, John Quincy Adams, lamented the fate of what he called that hapless race of Native Americans, which we are exterminating with such merciless and perfidious cruelty. Among the heinous sins of this nation, for which I believe God will one day bring it to judgment, earthly judgment awaits. And these are not the staples of taught history, they're only the staples of actual history. On the contrary, what we constantly hear is odes to our unique magnificence called American exceptionalism. Also not unique to the United States, but very striking right now. The later history of humanitarian intervention is not very different. After World War II, there are actually a few cases of military intervention that had very benign outcomes. Actually, there are two in the post-World War II period. both in the 1970s. In 1971, India invaded East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and terminated a monstrous slaughter of millions of people by the Pakistani army. At the end of the decade, 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and put an end to Pol Pot's atrocities, drove out the Khmer Rouge, just at the moment when they were peaking. But these two examples don't enter the canon of humanitarian intervention because they had a problem. The problem is wrong agency. It's only humanitarian intervention when we do it. We are our clients. And there was another problem with these two cases. The U.S. bitterly opposed them and moved very quickly to punish those who had carried out the crime of ending these slaughters and atrocities. In the case of India, that was Kissinger and Nixon at the time. Kissinger particularly was outraged by this. It was threatening to undermine a secret trip he was planning to Pakistan. He'd already set up all the photo ops and so on. It looked like this might undermine it. We know from recent White House tapes that were released that Kissinger was so furious, he was proposing to Nixon that they use nuclear weapons to stop it. What he said is that if we don't use nuclear weapons, the Russians will attack China and we'll be finished. That's the great diplomat, Henry Kissinger. Nixon was a little more restrained. He thought that mass famine in India would be enough of a punishment for this crime. And Kissinger went on to mock those who, as he put it, who bleed for the slaughtered Bengalis, the millions of them, who cares about them? Well, fortunately, Nixon prevailed. There was no Armageddon, although the United States did send an aircraft carrier into the Sea of Bengal to warn the Indians of the punishment that they deserve for the crime of one of the two crimes of intervention that actually had major benign consequences. The other was 1979. Vietnam was bitterly condemned for the crime of ending Pol Pot's atrocities. The New York Times denounced them as the Prussians of Asia. The United States imposed harsh sanctions. The United States imposed harsh sanctions and, in fact, supported an immediate Chinese invasion to punish the criminals who ended the Pol Pot crimes, and the United States immediately turned to supporting the Khmer Rouge and on the borders and their attacks against Cambodia, diplomatic and military support. So those two cases can't qualify as humanitarian intervention. If you look on, there are, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the concept of humanitarian intervention became very popular, and there was a good reason for it. Prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, every U.S. intervention could be justified as defense against the Russians. Didn't matter how ludicrous the pretense was, you could always claim defense against the Russians, so you didn't need any other pretexts. But with the Russians gone, some new pretext was needed to carry out the same policies, which of course was done. So humanitarian intervention was called upon. The 1990s were a very interesting period of American history and, in fact, general intellectual history. There has never been a period, to my knowledge, of such effusive praise for the magnificence of any state on the part of the most respected intellectuals, respected figures. So, to give you a couple of examples from the highest, most respected people, the United States was an idealistic new world bent on ending inhumanity everywhere. Its foreign policy entered a noble phase with a saintly glow. That's Clinton. For the first time in history, a state has arisen that is dedicated to principles and values. That's Václav Havel. acting from altruism alone and moral fervor, hence free to use force, where its leaders believe it to be just, supported by the enlightened states who are its respectful allies. That's a small sample of a deluge, again, from the most respected and honored liberal voices, while all through the years the crimes and atrocities mounted. I don't have time to run through them. Well, there was a jewel in the crown, which the final triumph of this noble phase and saintly glow. Now, that was the bombing of Serbia in 1999, the Kosovo intervention. There was an enormous chorus of self-congratulation. There was an international commission led by Judge Goldstone, Goldstone Commission of South Africa, which did, of distinguished lawyers, concluded that the bombing was illegal, but it was legitimate. And that phrase, illegal but legitimate, has haunted us since. And why was it legitimate? Because it was undertaken to stop an ongoing atrocities. There are a couple of problems with that story, which is uniform. It's repeated today constantly. One problem is the chronology. It happens to be the other way around. The bombing was the cause of the atrocities. It was not a consequence of them. We have extensive documentation of this, one of the most richly documented cases in history. Two huge State Department publications, United Nations reports, monitors on the ground, British parliamentary inquiry, and they all say the same thing. It was an unpleasant place until the bombing, but the bombing set off the atrocities. And in fact, if you look at the indictment of Milosevic for the crimes in Kosovo, you look closely, you'll notice that with a single exception, they all follow the bombing, because that's when the atrocities took place. Furthermore, it was anticipated. The General Wesley Clark, informed Washington a couple of weeks earlier in a discussion about what would happen, that if NATO, meaning the United States, did bomb, of course the Serbs would react with atrocities on the ground. He also informed the press as the bombing began that it was predictable that there would be a sharp increase in atrocities. So these horror stories you've seen are real, but they're the consequence of the intervention. So that's one problem. Now, that one is easily handled just by suppressing the historical record, almost totally suppressed, richly documented, almost nothing about it. There was another problem, that the traditional victims of intervention vigorously objected. There was a major meeting shortly after of the South Summit, that's basically the non-aligned countries, about 80% of the world's population, and they bitterly condemned what they called the so-called right of humanitarian intervention, referring to Kosovo, which they described as simply old-fashioned imperialism in a new guise. Well, that one could also be handled. It wasn't reported. A few mentions of it were derided, but it did cause a slight problem. One problem was that the notion humanitarian intervention was somewhat tainted in insignificant parts of the world, namely 80% of the world, but it was a little hard to maintain. So the intellectual classes had to ride to the rescue with some new notion. And the new notion is what's called responsibility to protect, R2P. That was concocted right after Serbia to try to deal with this problem. Well, I should say that Kosovo is also regarded as a precedent. The recent debate over bombing, not much of a debate over bombing Syria, did point out that it would be illegal but legitimate because international law has changed. And many commentators, even the President of France, pointed out that international law is a flexible notion. It changes as a result of actions that are taken, actions of state that set precedents, and the United States set a precedent by bombing Kosovo. Actually, this is not quite accurate. So, for example, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, that didn't set a precedent. When the Russians invaded Afghanistan, of course, not a precedent. And what is really meant in this discussion is when the most powerful and violent states carry out an action, those who are in a position to control and shape the way history is presented, that sets a precedent. That's the reality of it. Nevertheless, there was a problem. You needed something new. R2P, Responsibility to Protect, came along, constantly invoked. It's claimed to be legitimate because it was supported by the United Nations, which is about half true. There was a recent article you may have seen in the New York Times by Michael Ignatieff lauding humanitarian R2P and saying we have to invoke it. There's a book about him by Derek, which you should look at, recent book on this great humanitarian. Ignatieff, like others, had to ignore a slight problem here, too. There are two versions of R2P. One of them, in fact, was adopted by the United Nations, 2005. UN General Assembly adopted a responsibility to protect doctrine. But that one has a condition. It says it has to be within the framework of the United Nations Charter. So you can have intervention to protect people, but only on the condition that it is either authorized by the Security Council or that it's an immediate response to an ongoing armed attack, otherwise as illegitimate as before. Fortunately, there's another version of R2P. That's the one that the West appeals to while appealing to the UN for legitimacy. The second one is the concept developed by a commission led by Gareth Evans, Prime Minister of Australia, who's a noted violent interventionist himself. But this one is the operative version of R2P. It's the same as the UN version with one exception. It has a paragraph stating that in the event that the Security Council does not agree on the use of force, regional organizations can carry out military intervention within the area of their jurisdiction, subject to subsequent authorization by the General Assembly, by the United Nations. Well, there's only one regional organization that can do this, namely NATO, and its area of jurisdiction is the world. So what the U.S., the Western version, the operative version, the Ignatieff version and others, what that says is that NATO can do whatever it likes, independent of international law. Take, say, Libya. Libya is an African state. It's within the African Union. That's the regional organization. They were not silent about the bombing of Libya. They were strongly opposed to it. You didn't read it here. But they were strongly opposed. The African Union gave a series of proposals, sensible proposals, for diplomacy and negotiations to try to achieve the end of the civil strife without leading to a humanitarian crisis, as the bombing in fact did. Well, they were disregarded. They are not the kind of regional organization that is authorized to take a position under the Responsibility to Protect doctrine. Libya, as you know, is now a total ruin. You can read about it in the paper this morning. It's such a disaster that they've even had to stop exporting oil almost entirely. Well, the fact is that whatever term is used, the accepted canon of humanitarian intervention, the one accepted here, you know, at Harvard by distinguished intellectuals, by Western powers, that's the one that authorizes aggression and violence by the powerful, whatever name is given to it. That's official history. The real history is an annoyance, which is easily ignored, if we, of course, allow it to be ignored.
I'm Zareen, and I have two questions for you, if I may ask. In a country that has been so oppressed I would like to understand what gave you the courage and the motivation, and was it your upbringing? Was it something inside you? What helped you be who you are and be able to speak up? And my second question was, what do you see as the outcome of all your efforts that will be realistic outcomes? Are you alleviating suffering as best you can as you see it, or do you have a plan for transformation, and do you see that in your lifetime?
The first part of your question, I think that the disaster is going on there is enough that our do not let our consciousness that to be silent or sit silent. As right now in front of my people is two ways, sit silent or do a struggle. As we have told for history, we never accept occupation, and now it become like open secret for these Afghans that our country has been occupied and these terrorist puppets imposed on Afghans. So the support of my people encouraged me. This international solidarity gives hope, courage, determination that not sit silent and looking at how I'm walking in the day by day, it's proof for me that walking to the right direction. As always, I'm saying to my supporter that what I said, I wish that came wrong, that then I should apologize to my people and supporter around the world. But unfortunately, what I have been saying coming true at least this 10 years. And also the history, powerful history that we have is enough that to learn from, and especially from the hero and heroine of Afghanistan that we have to follow their path, whom are tied, men and women. Anyway, different reasons that do not let me to sit silence. And as Martin says, there come a time in the history that silence is like betrayal. And also, you said about how it is realistic. You mean that if I do not misunderstand it, since I am alive, to see in my life what I'm saying come true, yeah?
And do you have a plan? Do you think it will transform?
Yeah, plan for this. You know, we work for justice together, like network. I'm not alone. Yeah, we are working like in the name of Defense Committee, that we have this network, we are like group working, but like a party, but don't have name. Also, other Democrat Party supporters that together as the first demand of people, as I said, is justice. Collecting document of their crimes for the future, that not nationally, internationally, bring them to the court. First, we should raise political awareness of these most of non-educated suffer people of Afghanistan. This is the main goal, the main project and plan that we have, and also to make them organized. For these goals that we have, is educationally trying. The education is another plan that I have, but the most important, I believe the key. When these people become educated, especially at least this half of population, they never kill themselves when someone rape them or commit crimes against them. These men never go, as some Afghans go with Taliban to take their revenge from the warlords. To go with one terrorist to fight against another terrorist make no sense. So they have contact with us. As here I'm working underground with these people, groups and groups of people underground I meet, and then they do the political discussion and working for this cause. Justice, execution of these warlords, Taliban, these puppets, these killers, and against occupation, doing organized and open their eyes and working for education. And this list can be prolonged, so this is our plan for the future. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Tim Cargan with Veterans for Peace. I had mentioned this to Malalai before this event started. I'm sorry if it already exists. If it does exist, please publicize a central website where we can cut out the middlemen and support different groups and individuals directly. As Malalai's co-author had just mentioned, a lot of the money may be going to people who shouldn't be getting it. And I'd like to think that some of the internet technology may allow some anonymity so that even if people were working underground, maybe they could still get funds? Like one of your assistants said that you can't necessarily publicize someone's name if they're working underground. So maybe there's some way to leverage internet technology to get funds to those folks. Does that have all the different individuals and groups and all their info and the
No, it just has some groups.
Yeah.
But okay. Another one is the Afghan Women's Mission, the co-sponsor of this tour. It's a conduit for funds to Afghan projects.
Yeah, and also these democratic-minded organizations, these social networks, or some Democrat NGOs, I mean that honest NGOs and activists. If you want to know about their activism and follow, then there is my email. If you send an email, ask this question, all their websites and their Facebook, all this information I sent you, like this Solidarity Party, like Rawa organization, like social justice seekers, like OPAC, HACA, AFICO, there is not a number, but for more than parties, we have intellectuals in Afghanistan. Their contact is also good to get you to have link with them, to work together, and this defense committee itself is also like a group. You should encourage them. Most of them volunteer. All of them, I can say they are volunteer, and they are working there and active. Yeah.
Thank you.
This is a question for Malalai. You said that you see the Taliban and the warlords as a product of the White House. So my question is, in Afghanistan, is there a perception that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden might also have been a CIA fiction from the beginning? Because that opinion is shared by a sizable percentage of the American population. And there's a movement in the country, they call it 9/11 Truth. So I'm curious what your perception of 9/11 Truth is and what the perception of the people of Afghanistan is. Is that a correct way that might be true, or do you think those ideas are wrong-headed?
Yeah, the first part, only the last part of your question I didn't catch, but the first part you said about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. You know, all these terrorists are same. They have links in a way with each other. And these extremist fundamentalists and these terrorists, who, especially religious, is a good tool in the hands of them to use it against the people, and they are product of the White House, especially in other Western big powers. And Al-Qaeda, now you see how hypocrite U.S., at least now you see that how in Libya they supported these terrorists, this Al-Qaeda, and against dictator like regime like Gaddafi, removed and brought in power these fundamentalists. In Syria now you are looking how they are giving weapons and arms and support these fundamentalists here. It shows the hypocrisy of the U.S. regime that one day they are their friend, another day their enemies, and just when you see their background, all that they created by mainly by U.S. as a superpower, and Osama bin Laden himself, that how you saw that it was especially for them a good reason that to occupy Afghanistan with this 9/11 that happened, and then they played this game of Tom and Jerry with Osama and these were Taliban as they did. And then finally, Osama eliminated by Obama's administration to pretending like a hero. And anyway, as you see that how no difference between the Obama's administration and Bush. Even Obama is, I believe, for this wrong policy that he have in waging the war, is the second and even dangerous Bush. And but for U.S. is very easy to create another Osama for the execution, for the justification of their criminal war, let's say like this. Anyway, and the godfather of all these terrorists is the U.S., and one day, if it was good for them, for their dirty agendas they have, they say they are their enemies, another day they are their friends, just like a family fighting among them, fighting between husband and wife.
My question is a simple one. Have they succeeded in closing the girls' underground schools?
Well, you know, education, how much important the government says that, Western media says, Western government, that 6 million girls go to school. And it's a good reason for justification of their occupation. But now there is many reports, even from the ministry office of this puppet regime, 100 doors of schools now has been closed for lack of security. Even Taliban in faraway provinces burn their schools and destroy, and even the girls and when go to school, these warlords and Taliban both, they too assist or kidnap or rape. Anyway, education, how much important, it's not in their program that really empowers people educationally, especially women. Just they have some projects, especially in big cities, for justification of their occupation. Like in Kabul, Herat, Mazar Sharif, you see some women and girls have access to education. But in other provinces, the level of education is very low, even. And even in Kabul, in the University of Kabul, those who graduate, even they, some of them, I see that they cannot write well. And the education, the level is very low. Anyway, and many times the teachers and students, they have a strike, demonstration. For months, they are not receiving their salaries. Even they have some books that they are doing, like brainwash these girls and these boys. Like one gun is equal to two, one gun plus two gun is equal to how many gun? Or one infidel has been killed by one communist, by one foreigner, and something like this. You know, they are indirectly doing brainwash. The books released by Nebraska. Anyway, many examples like this. All right, thank you.
What is the most significant humanitarian intervention of the United States? And I would like to say just two phrases. I'm taking the chance. That there are also other kinds of intervention and other kinds of intervention and manners that can rule, ruin, and destroy a country and its people, such as economic war and economic occupation, which is happening the last 3 years in my country, Greece. Thank you.
Well, I can't really think of the most significant humanitarian intervention, because I can't think of any humanitarian intervention. And it's not just the United States. Try to find one in history. It's not easy. Maybe you can somewhere dig one up. But can you think of one? A genuine humanitarian intervention? I mean, there are interventions that have had a very benign effect. I mentioned two. The two main ones in the post-Second World War period, India and Vietnam. But those don't count. First, of course, we didn't do them, and we opposed them. And again, and if you really look at them, they weren't undertaken with the aim of ending atrocities. They were undertaken for other aims, and they did end massive atrocities. But to find a genuine humanitarian intervention, one taken by a state with the goal of ending atrocities selflessly, see if you can dig one up. Scholarly literature can.
Hi, I'm Alicia Santa Zachary. I'm a student at Tufts University. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on the role of Afghan youth in the progressive movement. And how the movement's reaching out to youth to encourage them to be a part of it.
Yeah, youth, you know, that they're the victim of these more than three decades of the war. So more than everyone, they are against the war, and they are active there, fortunately. At least this Democratic Party, I told you, Solidarity Party of Afghanistan, and these social justice seekers, this running by youth there. And their leaders are youth, and their members, most of them are youth, and they are so brave there and active. And there also we see students of the university when I have meeting underground with them, that how they politically discuss, and always with this question they come, what we can do, how we can bring positive changes, especially this glorious uprising happened that in these countries, Arab countries, even they are following the protests in U.S. and these countries. They are so emotional and happy about this, giving them hope, and also they agree with this and following this. And same in their country, they do campaign for this cause. But unfortunately, as I said, those who are in power, it's very risky for them. Most of them have to be underground Fidel active there, and you see at least some of these demonstrations that how they are active, and their eager to education is very a point of hope, most important point of hope, that how they have eager not only to education. Internet is we live in the century of 21st, that unfortunately they don't have this golden chance that to do campaign for democracy, for freedom against occupation. Right now, 2% Afghan, they have access to internet, there is official report. But there we see that how those who have access, they do campaign through these social networks. And if you want, I can give their contact, and you should be stay in contact with them, encourage them more.
Yes, sir. Stan Heller, TSPN. I have a question about the 80s. There are some groups in the United States who claim that when the Soviets were in there, it was a golden age of rights for women. I know Rawa disagrees, and I would like both speakers perhaps to talk about that period.
It was not a golden age for rights for anyone. It was a horror story. But the fact of the matter is that towards the end of the Soviet invasion in Kabul, it was a period in which women had significant rights. Actually, there are several publications about them, about this, by a woman named Rasil Basu. She's a well-known international feminist figure. She's one of the people who founded the International Rights of Women Day in 1974. And she was the UN ambassador to Afghanistan with special concern for the rights of women in the last years of the late 1980s. And she wrote several articles which were quite interesting. She was a very sensible person. She certainly didn't claim it was a paradise, anything like that. But, well, you can talk about it better than I can. But she described pretty high degree of freedom for a segment of educated, relatively privileged women at the universities who did face dangers. But the dangers they faced were that people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the U.S. favorite, throwing acid in the faces of women who were not, as they say, weren't dressed properly. She has several interesting articles about it. You can find them with some effort. She submitted the articles to the U.S. press. They refused to publish them, the mainstream media. She submitted the articles to Ms. Magazine, the feminist magazine. They refused to publish it because you're not supposed to say that. So she ended up publishing them in, I think it was in Asia Times, an India-based journal. But you can find them. So that did exist, but it certainly wasn't a golden age for women or anyone else. It was a horror story.
I think I already answered your question. During my speech and also the slide also was enough that I think maybe you were not on that time. Anyway, but do you want me to give more example of this?
Well, I know that Rawa was against the Soviet occupation, even though there may have been some positive aspects for women.
Oh, you're asking about Soviet time regarding... Oh, sorry, I misunderstood the question. Anyway, but you know, Soviet, when the role of the Soviet, when you compare with the role of the fundamentalists when they were in power in Taliban and even the 12 years of occupation, this too, when you compare, we have that, how to explain this in English to you, that time was better than this time when you compare, like between bad and worse. That is bad and this is worse, you know? Like this, I hope you understand what I say. But they committed crimes under the name of socialism. They did. They have nice banner like good food for people, good house, blah blah. And but like now, USA, they have good banner like women rights, human rights, like this. But regarding the woman, especially a woman that the woman situation you asked was, you even cannot compare with this extremist fundamentalist warlords in Taliban, but they have many things in common, like both, they are also puppets, Taliban and warlords also puppets. They were on that time, they committed crimes under the name of secularism, and now they are talking about Islam, this puppet of Russia. The difference was that, like, these warlords in Taliban did massacre without making list of the people. They did massacre in Pondicherry jail with the list, as one list of their crimes I said now released. Regarding the woman, for example, on that time, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar party, these extremist fundamentalists, they threw the seat, as Professor Noam Chomsky also said about this. There was happening some examples at the beginning, but the policy that they had was wrong. For example, most people are, one example I'm giving you, most people are Muslim. This is Muslim country, but they were pretending to do couple when they marry, if to bring mullah, it is religious. No need to bring mullah, no need to be maker, something like this. And they were organizing such kind of marriage parties. And it was too much for the people, for this Muslim people. It's like to impose on someone to wear a scarf or not wear a scarf, you know? Like they were being not wear a scarf. Many examples like this, but no question that they were progressive, they were intellectual. When you compare with the Taliban and warlords, the puppet of Russia, they call themselves, we are communists, we are socialists, but they killed countless, hundreds and hundreds of those who were socialists, those who were communists. Same like their ideology, but they were not puppets. And they just eliminated them. And regarding the women also, that those women who were activist women, those who were against the role of them, it was easy for them to eliminate or have to leave. Or to be silent, otherwise they killed them. Yeah.
Yes. Hi.
One sentence I want to add. And now also that they are part of this regime, especially they are running the intelligence service in Afghanistan. As they are intellectuals, I can't say intellectual. How I should say so-called intellectual? I mean that educated one, and they run in this intelligence service, and because these warlords and Taliban are so stupid and not educated. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you all for coming. It's been a pleasure to listen to you all speak. My question is related to, you referenced the U.S. troops, the source of the problem being U.S. troops still in Afghanistan. My question relates to, U.S. troops left Iraq officially about 2 years ago. My question is, why did the U.S. decide to withdraw from Iraq, for instance, earlier? There's still, the U.S. Has not withdrawn from Afghanistan completely. What's the motivation for keeping troops there? Do you believe President Obama when he says he really wants to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan? And what's preventing that from happening?
I will answer this, then Professor Chomsky also can answer this question. In Iraq, it is true that they apparently they left Iraq, but the puppet regime remained there. And what they did in Iraq alone is unforgivable and unforgettable. U.S. And same like what they did in Iraq, they occupied Iraq because of oil of Iraq, and now indirectly they interfered there and they have their own puppet regime there. And it still continued their barbarism in different ways. Same now in Afghanistan, as now it become like open secret for them, this endless disgusting war. They are making more powerful their puppet regime by bringing Taliban also in power, make more unite these killers, and also expanding their military bases here, going to legalize their military bases, and they have countless secret military bases to continue to their barbarism again. And then a few thousands of the troops leave, but they remain their bases and their puppet regime. Then, same like what they did in Iraq, they control. And as Professor Chomsky said regarding the Iraq alone, embassy of Iraq, if I'm not wrong, that you said like city within a city, a huge city within a city. I read. Yeah, according embassy of U.S., it is exactly same like in Afghanistan. And many things we have in common. But in Afghanistan, why they choose? In Afghanistan, because of the geopolitical location of Afghanistan. We are in the heart of Asia. There's many reasons they don't want, and they will never leave voluntarily Afghanistan. Of course, through Afghanistan control these Asian powers, China, Russia, etc., and have easily access to the gas and oil of the Central Asian Republics. Especially, they are working on the project of the pipeline, going to finish it by support of the puppets. And also, they are receiving billions of dollars from opium industry, as after oil and gun, trade of oil and gun, they are making a lot of money from this dirty business of opium. And also, they are looting our rich resource that here we have, as our copper mine is the second best copper mine in the world. And we have uranium, lithium, blah, blah. And many examples like this, that they, these are the reasons, main reasons, that they never leave Afghanistan voluntarily. Yeah. And Professor Chomsky, do
you? Add a word about Iraq. The United States had no intention of leaving Iraq. They were forced to. Iraq was a total defeat, extreme defeat for the United States. If you want to check it, take a look at the, there was an official declaration of the Bush administration in November 2007, right toward the end, in which they, the administration stated its long-term goals for Iraq. There were two conditions. One was that the U.S. has military bases in Iraq, which it can continue to use for combat operations and, of course, for its position in the Middle East. The second was that U.S. corporations must be privileged in their access to Iraqi resources, meaning oil. That was November 2007. In January 2008, that was reinforced by one of these famous signing statements, you know, when the president has to sign a legislation, but he adds, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to live up to it. It's called a signing statement. In January 2008, there was such legislation, appropriations legislation, and Bush and his, whoever writes his comments for him, added that a signing statement saying that they would not sign anything that restricted these two objectives. That was January 2008. They couldn't get away with it. The Iraqis refused. Iraqi nationalism was strong enough to prevent the U.S. from carrying forward these intentions. So Bush had to start the withdrawal process. Now Obama has just continued Bush's program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your talk. It was very... it was great. I have two questions, one from Malalai, one from Professor Chomsky. Malalai, there are countries that never recover, and the destruction, the chaos, the even the infrastructure becomes so damaged that the country never comes back. And I will give an example of Haiti today. Given the circumstances and the current situation of your country, do you think that if there is still a hope of the country recovering once the United States leaves and the country becomes again its own, with handling its own business, that the tools are still there and the structure is still there to the country come back? And I'm going to ask Professor Chomsky now. Puerto Rico has been part of the United States since the Spanish-American War. My country, Dominican Republic, has been invaded twice by the United States. And even last year, the United States said that there is an island out of the coast of the South that they want to put a military base for the sake of protecting the country against drug trafficking. That's actually a natural oasis for many birds that fly from Florida to the corner of the island. Now, my question for you is the following. For a country that can not even agree on a budget, for a country that is clearly divided in opinion, whether it's the general media, whether it's the left media, right media, doesn't matter, I see that the war machinery is still intact. They cannot agree on general several things, but when it comes to war, invasions, putting military bases, how and why do this happen?
What country?
Dominican Republic.
So why are there bases established?
Yeah, and why is the military war strategy intact?
Why does the U.S. military want the bases?
How does this keep happening, even in a country that is in so much disarray economically right now, and they're still expanding everywhere, and who controls that? Where it comes from? For a country in Congress, they cannot even agree on a budget.
What it means to run the world.
It's simply power and violence. Dominican Republic's a perfectly good example. Woodrow Wilson invaded the Dominican Republic, and half destroyed it. It did even a more monstrous attacks on the other half, Hispaniola, Haiti. The Dominican Republic supported dictatorships, Trujillo, a whole series of dictatorships. In 1965, it looked as if there was going to be an independence movement in the Dominican Republic. Johnson sent the troops and put that one down, and so it continues. It's simply violence. Do you know any other country in the world that has 800 military bases around the world? Nobody else has the power to do it. France has about 2, I think. Britain doesn't have any anymore. The United States has maybe 800, maybe 1,000. That's what power is. And the countries that don't want it are treated like the Dominican Republic. They're invaded. Or the government's overthrown. Well, right now, first of all, the government generally functions reasonably well. Right now, there is a serious problem. The government is not functioning. But that's something pretty special in the last roughly 10 years. What's happened in the United States, and this has not affected the military, they, if you notice, are still getting funded and so on. What's happened in, generally speaking, in the United States, last generation, is that there have been significant economic changes. So the economy's moved towards financialization, destruction of the productive part of the economy. It's still there, but it's offshore, Bangladesh, China, and so on. So there's a exportation of production, financialization of the economy. It's led to very sharp concentration of wealth, as you know, and stagnation for most of the population. This is the concentration of wealth leads to concentration of political power automatically, which keeps the vicious cycle going because of new legislation, deregulation, and so on. All of this has led to a situation, and meanwhile, the cost of elections is skyrocketing, not just presidential, congressional, everything. The net effect is that power is very heavily concentrated in a tiny group, which is pretty far to the right. If you go back 30 or 40 years, there was a kind of a standard quip, which was sort of accurate, that the United States is a one-party state, the business party, with two factions. And now it's a one-party state with one faction, and it's not Democrats. It's moderate Republicans who call themselves Democrats. The Democratic Party shifted so far to the right that it's kind of like what moderate Republicans were a generation ago. The Republican Party has gone off the spectrum. There's nothing like it in any parliamentary system. They have so dedicated themselves to the ultra-rich and the corporate sector that they can't get votes. And in order to get votes, they've had to mobilize sectors of the population which have been around, but were never a political force before. So the religious right, for example, it's a huge sector in the United States. Nativists who want to keep everybody out because they've taken everyone's thing away from us. It's a very frightened country. It always has been. So people who are afraid they've got to have guns to defend themselves from the UN or the federal government or whatever. These sectors of the population have been mobilized. The Republican establishment is trying to control them, and it can't. That's what's happening in Washington now. This is not just, this opinion is expressed by the most respected conservative figures. The most respected conservative political analyst in the country is Norman Ornstein, American Enterprise Institute, a very right-wing institute. He simply describes the new Republican Party as what he calls a radical insurgency, which has no interest in parliamentary politics, won't accept science, won't accept anything. They just have their own fanatic beliefs. If somebody says there's global warming, you get somebody on Fox News saying we'll leave it in the hands of the deity. No. Now, that's what's going on. So, yes, under those conditions, the government is dysfunctional. But that hasn't, it's not what has happened with, it's not what's happened in the past, and it's not, plenty of things wrong, but not that. And it's, it hasn't affected, maybe it will affect the military, but it hasn't so far. And it certainly hasn't throughout this whole period when the military system expanded all over the world. And in fact, right now, the U.S. is expanding its military base system quite extensively. So, for example, Africa is being saturated with what will become, already partially are, but will become military bases. So it continues. But the dysfunction is real, and it's due to a sharp drift to the right in the whole mainstream society, the establishment, the economy, the social system, the political system, and so on. I mean, somebody like, say, Richard Nixon today would be way out on the left. In fact, Congress today is trying to dismantle Nixon's relatively progressive accomplishments. That's what's happened to the country. It's an international scandal.
According to your question, you know, as always I say that U.S. and NATO, these foreigners, let us to break a little bit in peace. If they leave us alone, then I'm sure my people, even with empty hands, they will build their countries. But unfortunately, the interference of these foreigners, they is still, and not only that they are there for their own interests and they have these different kind of dirty agendas as this one dirty British policy nowadays, they are playing dividing roles there in Afghanistan. Even they are, we are very worried about the division of Afghanistan. We are talking about reconstruction of Afghanistan. While a U.S. senator says once the only solution of Afghanistan is federalism. Federalism, you know, division. And also all British politicians says publicly that the Afghanistan solution is division. And anyway, and nowadays there are a group of warlords going to Germany. There are these wrong politicians organized for them big expensive conferences and they say the solution is federalism. And as publicly they are talking, we are really worried about this division of our country. About, well, you say reconstruction, it is so easy. No question that we need a helping hand while we want the withdrawal of the troops, international solidarity of justice-loving people around the world, morally and financially, especially educationally, they should support our people. And these projects that we have for education, reconstruction of Afghanistan, women's rights, etc. Anyway, but you mentioned the example of Haiti. Let me give you the example of Sierra Leone. Look, in Sierra Leone, they are the most diamond of the world is there. If I pronounce correct, Sierra Leone. You know Sierra Leone? Sierra Leone. This African country, Sierra Leone. There is the most diamond of the world is there.
Sierra Leone.
Yeah, Sierra Leone. Yeah, but the most poor people is living here. Afghanistan is the second one, like the second Sierra Leone. And Haiti and many other countries, when you see in a way in the behind of this, all these miseries and all these wars going on there for endless time, is the hand of these foreigners for their own interests. And just I wanted, regarding the question before our one of our supporters asked that according Russia puppet, I want to tell you that in point of view of my people, this puppet of Russia is, they have the responsibility of the beginning of this disgusting war in Afghanistan. As during the Cold War, they created this kind of situation, opportunity for the U.S. to create these fundamentalist extremists that give them weapons, empower them, and then they come in power, the civil war. their responsibility is more. They are more criminals. They are the people want as now and always the public prosecution of them. And they say they have the responsibility of the starting of this disgusting war in Afghanistan. And secondly, two times they committed crimes. Once in the past, as I said, in the name of socialism, when they were in power, committed crimes. And now, with nice banner of the U.S., joined their hands with extremist fundamentalists to get a continuity to their fascism. So, I don't know how to... And who, did you got what I mean? Yeah. Anyway, I'm wondering about my English. That's why I'm... As I wish, I can't explain sometimes.
Well, I feel honored to have attended this extraordinary meeting for both Professor Chomsky and Malalai. You are an extraordinary young woman, and we have a lot of faith in you. My question to Professor Chomsky is, given your description of this country, how long do you think the majority of Americans is going to take it? How are they going to cope with all these injustices that are happening in the country? And to Malalai, do you feel that your life is in danger when you go back to Afghanistan? What are you going to do to protect yourself? And then, are you running for office? Or do you think that there is another means to transform your country?
There's no answer to that question. Depends how much we can achieve. I mean, take things that have been achieved, okay, and ask how long it took. So, for example, the two original sins of the country were slavery and extermination of the indigenous population. How long has it taken for those to be overcome? Well, the indigenous population is virtually destroyed. I mean, they kind of survive, but under horrible conditions. Slavery is technically overcome, but other devices were quickly created which reinstated a version of slavery. I won't go through the history, but it happened in 1877, 10 years after the Civil War, effectively criminalizing black life, which sent black males into prisons where they became essentially a slave labor force. That changed that went on until the Second World War. Then there was a period in which economic growth and which substantial part of the black population could drift into the society. Finally, in the mid-60s, there was successful civil rights legislation, but we're now back in a period roughly like the late 19th century, with the black population criminalized, especially black males, under the totally fraudulent drug war, and being driven back into the prisons. So there's been progress, but it's not over, and the first slaves came in 1620. It's a long time. Let's take something that's had a little more progress, women's rights. How long did that take? Go back to the revolutionary period. Women were not persons. They were property. The founders of the country took over British common law under which a woman was the property of her father transferred to her husband. And one of the arguments against allowing women to vote in the early days of the Republic was that it would be unfair to unmarried men because a married man would have two votes because obviously the property votes the way its owner does. How long did that last? Well, you know, it wasn't until 1975 that women were accepted legally as peers in federal juries. women had no legal right to serve in a federal jury. You're supposed to be tried by a jury of your peers. But women didn't have that status until 1975. That's a pretty long time. It's changed, substantial change. Country's not like what it was 50 years ago. But you could never have predicted how long it was going to take. How long it was going to take depended on how much effort and energy and dedication and commitment would be put into changing it. And it's the same today.
I come from Afghanistan and will go back to ISIL. It's part of my struggle that traveling and attending in conferences that support us, the freedom-loving people of these countries, invite me and to bring the message of my people, to talk about realities of this so-called war on terror and these fundamentalists. Brutalities of these fundamentalists and asking for international solidarity, because otherwise we will leave all these tribune to these so-called Democrat women or men that who are traveling a lot and deceiving good people around the world. And from this frame, I want to use for the good cause for my people and support that they invite in different countries. That's the reason I'm coming. And of course, there is a risk, and I accepted this risk, and I'm not better than my people. And we do struggle together for bringing peace, democracy, women rights, these values in our country, and to do struggle against the occupation. And second part of your question, that an election, if I run, this previous election, people called me to run. I did boycott, same for presidential election. Even people don't see the number of my age. While because of my age, even I vote, I can't attend in this election, presidential election, because I must be 40 years old. Anyway, but we experience this fraudulent, ridiculous election in our country, especially for someone like me. If run for the election, it is clear, not possible, especially this time, to win. As they saw that what I did in the parliament, I exposed their mouth through Tribune of Parliament. I did not sit silent. And they know that, again, if I go to parliament, I will be the same person. As again, I believe even that parliament will be more mafia parliament than the previous one, as he experienced. Anyway, that's what I did about election, to be a political awareness, a chance for political awareness to the people. That's why I did boycott. Like millions of other Afghans, they boycott this election now, and they do not run. And the person will be winner who will sign the selling of Afghanistan. I mean that to their godfather, to be puppet of the U.S. That will be the winner of this election. Like our people use this proverb that the donkey will be same, but only saddle will change. That will be the result. Yeah.
I would like to thank Malala Joya and Noam Chomsky for their talk this evening.
Noam Chomsky and Malala Joya speaking at the Unitarian Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts on October 8th. This program was recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Radio Project. Thanks for listening.